I think if for anyone who was playing games pre-3D, that revolution, like pre-Super Mario 64, the moment that happens, it felt momentous in a way that probably people who don't play video games are like, what are you talking about? These are just toys, stop it. But like, if you care about video games and you think they're important, living through that moment was incredible.
Hello and welcome to Why Button, the podcast that asks why we care about video games. I'm your host, Kyle Starr. On this show, I interview creators, enthusiasts, journalists, and media personalities about their origins with video games, what keeps them so interested in the medium, and what excites them about the future. On this episode, I'm joined by award-winning journalist and author Simon Parkin. Most notably, Simon is a contributing writer for The New Yorker, but you'll also find his byline in The Guardian, The New York Times, British GQ, and loads of others. He is the author of three nonfiction books, including one of my favorites, Death by Video Game. On top of his writing, Simon is the host of the video game podcast My Perfect Console. It's a show I've recommended on this podcast before, as it shares the similarity of exploring the meaning video games play in our lives, albeit with a very impressive set of guests, including people like Josh Wardle, the creator of Wordle, Ashley Birch, Phil Fish, Ronan Farrow, Peter Molyneux, Jennifer Hale, Lucas Pope, Brian Lee O'Malley, just to name a few. A quick heads up on this one. When Simon and I chatted, I think I was picking up his headphone microphone, which led to some pretty terrible audio. Thanks to Simon's recommendation of Adobe's Enhance AI, as well as my producer AJ's audio wizardry, I think things came out pretty okay. Certainly much better than they were to begin with, but I say this in the event you notice any audio wonkiness, but I'll let you be the judge. Simon Parkin, welcome to Why Button. Thank you for joining me today. This is a real pleasure, as I'm a big fan of yours, your current podcast and your writing as well. Yeah, so this is a huge pleasure for me.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that.
I first learned about you when I picked up Death by Video Game, which is a book that you wrote a while ago.
Yes.
The premise for people who haven't actually read the book, I'm just going to read a short snippet off the dust cover here. Riveting and wildly entertaining, Death by Video Game will change the way you think about our virtual playgrounds as it investigates what it is about them that often proves compelling, comforting, and irresistible to the human mind, except for when it's not. And that bit about compelling, comforting, and irresistible to the human mind, I read that going like, that's exactly why I make this podcast. Like,
yeah.
I'm so fascinated by this idea, you know, really just from my own lens about like, why do I care about this stuff so much? Why do I find it endlessly fascinating, even if I'm not actually playing the video games? I'm enamored in podcasts and media and news media and all that sort of stuff. And yeah. So I wanted to talk to people who maybe shares that same sort of sort of sentiment. And why not ask somebody like yourself what it is about this that fascinates you? How do we start this? How did you get into this racket? Like, what compelled you to start writing about this stuff?
Yeah, so the book you're talking about there, Death by Video Game, came out, I think, 8 years ago now. So sort of the first like proper book that I wrote that came out with proper publishers, like not a coffee table book. I contributed to a couple of things about video games. There's sort of like 1,001 games you should play before you die, that kind of thing before. But that was the first proper, written through book that I'd done that was based on a bunch of articles I'd written sort of over the years. That I brought together to create a kind of thesis about why we play video games and what goes wrong when we don't. And it was sort of different reasons. Each chapter is named after a different thing that I think people, you know, attracted to video games, you know, for, you know, be that community or a sense of belonging or, you know, challenge, whatever it is, sense of mystery. Some people just love video games because they like trying to find stuff out. Loads of video games facilitate that. And yeah, so the pieces that went into making that book, I probably started writing throughout my career, I guess, over the 6 or 7 years prior to that book coming out. I started out as a freelance journalist, writing exclusively about games, right out of university, really. As a kid, I was like really into collecting things, and my dad is a big collector. He collected gramophone needle tins. So these are when you owned like a gramophone vinyl player. So that's like a record player, but it's got one of those big horns that, you know, acts as an amplifier. And you would buy the little needles that would play the records, and they came in tins. And he had a massive collection of all these tins, like quite an obscure thing. But I would go with him to like the markets in London, and he would go searching for that stuff. And I had my own stuff that I was interested in and was trying to build up little collections. And one of those things was video games. And I was also into rare records and stuff. And when I was a teenager, one of the magazines I would read was called Record Collector. And it sort of was articles about the most interesting and rare records that have been around. They managed to bring it out monthly, and it also had a listing at the back of the magazine of, like, you know, the values that month of all the records that have ever come out. I don't know how they pulled it all together, but they did somehow. And yeah, I was sort of finishing my degree at university and was kind of thinking about what I might like to do. And I loved video games. I liked writing as well. And I kind of wanted to be a journalist. So I wrote to Future Publishing, which was the publisher of Edge magazine in the UK. And they also publish PC Gamer and stuff like that. And I just found an email address for one of the publishers in there and wrote to them. In fact, I think it was a phone number or something. Maybe I wrote a letter. I can't remember. Anyway, I wrote to them and said, look, I've got an idea for a magazine. I'd kind of like to do the video games version of Record Collector. Can I come and tell you about it? And the guy got back to me and was like, yeah, come to Bath, which is, I don't know, like 3 hours away from London, and tell us about your idea. So I did. I went down there and had a meeting. And yeah, I'm like 22 years old, don't know what I'm doing. but I had a lot of passion and had this meeting with him. And he was like, okay, you know, that sounds great. It's a good idea for a mag. There's, you know, this is before the era that people were into retro games as well. You know, really, there were no retro game publications at that time. So it was kind of a new thing in the market. But he said, you know, it costs a lot of money to launch a magazine. This is how much it costs to get it into shops in the UK. And he was like, why don't you just write it as a series of articles for Edge magazine, which is one of our well-regarded magazines here in the UK. So that's how I started. I basically became a freelancer for Edge, writing this series of articles each month. I would pick a different system. So I did one for like Sega Saturn, one for Super Nintendo. I don't know, about 12 of them. And a couple of other people wrote some as well. And then after maybe 18 months, they released a special edition of Edge, which was called the Collector's Edition, that had all of the articles that I'd worked on and some other people had as well, collected in one magazine. So I kind of got the thing I'd been dreaming of right at the start, if only for one issue. But basically that set me on the path. I was now a freelance writer for game magazines. And once you've written for one, you could kind of hustle and start writing for others and then start writing for websites. And yeah, I just kept doing that and eventually branched out into writing about things outside of games. And eventually got the chance to do the book that you were talking about right at the start.
Yeah, indeed. And so you're writing, for folks who don't know, you're writing, spans. Today, you know, your byline, correct me if I'm wrong here, but your byline, I feel like I've seen in, you know, the New Yorker, Guardian, the New York Times, and now you have three books out, one of which is about video games, the other two, some wartime nonfiction, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, as well.
Yeah.
You may be the first guest I've had with a Wikipedia page. This is not the question, but does it feel weird to have a Wikipedia page?
Oh gosh. I mean, you know, when you start writing books, it's partly because, you know, that things change and you start having, particularly, I think the weirder thing for me was having books on things that I have made on Amazon that anyone could review.
And you very quickly, they all say nice things.
They don't all say nice things. And you very quickly learn, like, the way to a, you know, to mental health is not paved with Amazon reviews. So you quickly learn not to read that stuff, I think, really. And that goes for like Wikipedia, that goes for everything that's written about you online. It just comes a point where you're like, actually, it's harder for me to do the things I need to do in the world if I look at that stuff. So I'm just not going to look at that stuff. And you know, I'm more interested in spending my time trying to put things into the world that I want to see be in the world. So, and it's helpful to just be, to a certain degree, you know, unaware of that stuff, I guess.
Yeah, I asked the Wikipedia thing because I read on there that your second book, I think it was A Game of Birds and Wolves, was, I guess, picked up by Amblin Productions. Yes, Steven Spielberg's house. I mean, that's very cool. I'll just say congratulations. That's amazing.
Actually, alas, I don't think it's happening now. So the Wikipedia pages is a bit out of date there, but
can also update your own Wikipedia page too, just
well, I mean, you know, the thing with those, you know, it's very exciting when things that you make get optioned, and that was obviously new to me, you know, entering the world of sort of narrative nonfiction. I've had like two or three things optioned now, and you quickly learn that it's very exciting, but most stuff doesn't get made, you know, for whatever reason. And yeah, that project did go quite a long way. There was like a full script written, and it was all very exciting. But then, it's kind of was happening through the pandemic, and this happens and that happens, and then it sort of peters out. So maybe it will come back around. Who knows? But as of right now, it's not happening.
More seriously, you're not a one note person. You obviously have interests other than games, and the two other books you've written are about wartime issues. What's the draw there for you?
Well, the first book that you were talking about there, the Amblin Options, is called A Game of Birds and Wolves, and it was about a game that a group of young women developed in the early 1940s during the Second World War to help uncover the tactics that the U-boats were using in the Battle of the Atlantic. So I was like, I came to that story from the world of game design. Like, I was interested in, oh, hang on, like, there's a board game that was played a massive role in the Second World War, that I'm interested in that. And that led me down the route to finding out more about this and wanting to write a book on it. And then, the second book that I wrote was not about games, but it was tangential to the first book setting. So then I was just on a new path and like writing about something else. And the next book I've got coming out later this year is about the Siege of Leningrad, which is very much not about games as well. But I think the book I'm going to do after that, that I'm about to start work on, I'm returning to the world of video games, but with everything I've learned from writing those narrative nonfiction books, sort of historically based. So I'm going to be working on a sort of, an amazing story from the 1970s and 1980s about the video game that's set within the world of video games. So yeah, it's all sort of, it looks like quite different, but there's similar muscles being used, I think, through all of this stuff. So there is a kind of through line, even though it might not look like it from the outside. Yeah.
That's incredibly exciting. I'm looking forward to that book. I think one thing that strikes me about you and your work is less about the video games. I think you have a very, unique and a great perspective on games. I think the thing that strikes me most about you is your writing style. Not to go too deep into that, but I mean, you enjoyed writing and you enjoyed games, but where did you, this sounds weird to ask, but like, where did you learn to write? Like your voice is incredibly, I guess, nuanced and just paints amazing pictures. So I'm wondering where that skill kind of, did you find yourself a natural writer or were you really drawn to certain writing styles and try to mimic or learn from them?
Incredibly kind of you. Thank you. Appreciate that. Yeah. Like it just took ages. Just took like years of being bad. Like everything, I guess. When I was at school, I liked writing. I wanted to become a writer. That was like one of the things I wanted to do most. And it was the thing that like I got praised for by teachers or whatever. But, there's a huge difference between that being okay at writing at school and then becoming a professional writer. So, it really helped starting out working, for Edge, where there were older writers who, I don't think wouldn't, mentoring is way too strong because, one of the things that the video game journalism industry is really bad at is actually mentoring and teaching people how to get better. But at least I was rubbing shoulders with people who knew how to do it. And I was able to learn from their example and, make lots of mistakes. And when I started writing for the internet as well, I think I saw that as a chance to try out some different things and different styles and have some experiments. And lots of those went very badly, I think. And I would cringe myself to death, like reading those pieces now. But, over time, learning how to get better, seeing other writers whose work I appreciated and liked and trying to figure out what they were doing and first trying to mimic it. And then slowly over a period of time, you start to develop your own voice. I would say I started writing for The New Yorker online, I think in 2013. And that was really a supercharge. The editing process there is far, far more involved than anything I'd ever experienced before. Mm. And that, just going through that process, just really ironed out a lot of the kinks maybe for me, taught me how to get rid of the bad habits and taught me how to develop better habits. So that was a huge privilege to have the chance to do that over the years and work with some fantastic editors. And then, but I suppose I was always interested in writing about games for an audience who weren't necessarily game players. And that was always something that I felt I could do and wanted to develop. So that helped as well, I think, wanting to write for an audience who maybe think video games are, oh, they're kind of a big deal, they're kind of interesting, but I don't play them and I probably won't play them, but I might want to read something about them. So, you know, me wanting to write for that kind of audience also probably helped develop a slightly different literary style, perhaps, or approach to writing about games compared to a lot of people who work in the field.
Sure. Was that some of that same intent part of your podcast, My Perfect Console?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I mean, you know, I suppose I am a podcaster and you referred to me that as one of my jobs, I suppose, in the start, and technically that's true, but I definitely see myself as a journalist first and foremost. And, you know, that's just a medium where I was like, I like interviewing people, I'm interested in people, and I wanted to interview people about their, you know, the games that mean a lot to them, specific games that want to mean a lot, that mean a lot to them, but also about their, you know, their own life stories, even separate to games. And I thought, you know, I'd done that for years as a journalist, but you do your interviews in private and then you write your piece up and then you publish it. So I was like, maybe I could just invite people to kind of listen into the interview part of that. That was really the motivation for it, if that makes sense.
Indeed. And you have quite a Rolodex of folks who join the podcast, and that's one of the things that makes it so appealing. It's quite incredible to hear the vast, not only I would say the celebrity of certain people, which is I think really, really cool and can draw a lot of people in, but you also have this very wide, wide reach of, I guess, types of people. I think one of my favorite episodes was actually one of your more recent ones. Is it Patrick House? Neuroscientist. Yes. I felt like that was such a fascinating conversation, and how he is able to link video games back to what he does, and how these two worlds sort of collide and intersect. That particular episode, I think he kind of threw your format, or not your format, but he threw your structure out a little bit too as you guys were chatting.
Yeah, definitely. Like, I mean, that episode is good because Patrick is good and is very articulate and able to, you know, he thought deeply about games and what they mean to him and was able to contextualize that in like really accessible, but quite a thoughtful way. So yeah, I mean, as you know, to a certain degree, if that ruins the format, so be it. I mean, it didn't ruin the format, it just sort of, you know, it meant I couldn't ask quite so much biographical stuff as I normally would, but that was absolutely fine.
Is there any particular conversation that you've had, I guess, on your show that you've just been kind of floored by or fascinated by?
I think there's an episode I did last year with Tom Bissell, who's a friend of mine, another writer who's written a book about games and who now writes screenplays. I've been friends with Tom for like a long time, but I don't get to see him very often. So that was just, I really treasured that conversation because we rarely just get an hour to talk, and also to do so where I was free to ask him questions, not as a friend, but as someone who's interested in what he might have to say about things. That's just such a like gift as a journalist. It just gives you, when you have that hat on, it gives you permission to ask things that you might not in any other capacity in life, even of your friends, right? And so yeah, I think, and Tom as well, like Patrick is just a very articulate person. And so yeah, I think that one came out well. Yeah,
I've had many of the folks I've had on this show have been friends and acquaintances that I've met over the years may have some notoriety in the space. The last episode prior to this was Chris Plant, editor-in-chief of Polygon.
And lovely guy.
I had to toe that line between I'm friends with Chris, but I also want to get, you know, I want to get a little deeper. And so,
right,
you know, those conversations, I agree. I treasure that conversation, but I also, it was maybe a little more challenging in some regard where I have to like take my friend hat off on occasion and then, you know, put it back on. And it was a fun little dance, I think. But you learn a little bit of that person you thought you knew, I guess, well to begin with.
Absolutely. Yeah. And like, when do you ever get to do that in like normal life? Just turn to like one of your buddies and go, what were you like at school? You know, or whatever. What did your parents do? Yeah, it's quite rare, particularly for men, I suppose.
Maybe it's just me. I do find myself trying to engage in these types of conversations more often with folks that I know of. I get really, really curious about people's sort of dreams, desires, careers, paths, journeys, regardless if it's a podcast or an interview or whatever,
right.
Just talking, even with friends, family, you know, sort of had this oft idea or dream to, you know, chronicle folks in my life, grandparents or even great grandparents, about like, what was their journey? I feel like everybody has a book in them, right? And so being able to dive into somebody else's story, let somebody else tell their story, I think is kind of fun and not something everybody gets a chance to do. And so I think providing that avenue is kind of nice. So
yeah, that's definitely like, you know, that's a journalistic instinct as well. Like, you should, if you're built that way, then like you should know loads of stuff about your taxi driver before you get out of the car, right? You should know why they're doing their job and blah blah blah, and how they came to the country or whatever it is. And you know, that's just, I think some people are built that way, and that's the job you should be doing if you are.
Indeed. There's also the part of me that I like to get in my Uber or my Lyft and say, I want it quiet, please. Thank you. I just need my own thoughts.
I don't want to know anything about you.
No. Why don't we let's dive into things a little bit. Actually, before we do, I did have one question about my Perfect Console. Do you do the music for it as well?
Yeah, I do. Yeah.
Is there anything you don't do?
So much. Yeah. And you should ask my wife.
Oh boy.
I sort of was in bands when I was a teenager, like a lot of people that do this kind of thing. I could see you've got like guitars on your wall, and you know, so I was just in like rock bands and things like that. So you know, I sort of work with audio lots and enjoy that side of things, and that's kind of like my hobby. So the chance to be able to like write, just mess around and make some music is like the bit of the making a podcast I could sort of enjoy the most because it's the bit where it's, you know, it feels separate to work, if yes. You see what I mean.
It's quite, yeah. And you're quite talented at it. The music on the show I find is very fun. And I like the, you know, the new little bits and pieces you threw in there for season two. It's just, you know, little extras. Hopefully that continues to evolve. You told me a little bit about why you even got into games journalism. This was, you know, you loved games, you loved writing, marry the two, boom, there you are. And you actually, you know, you followed your dream and you landed something that I think a lot of people strive for forever and just never, it never happens. But digging deeper, like what was that thing that drew you to games? It's sort of a silly question for our generation because we grew up with this medium. It was obviously the hot toy of the time, but there was something else that I think that, you know, while most kids were probably attracted to it then, there were a few of us that just kind of stayed enamored with that medium as it grew up. Yes, right? Some people just sort of drop off and go do other things, and that's fine. Find other hobbies. Great. But what was it about games that sort of kept pulling you along and kept you interested? Those aha moments.
Yeah. I don't know. I think about this a lot. Like, why do some people keep playing games and some people don't? And that is definitely an interesting question. I mentioned Tom earlier. He had a piece that he wrote for Grantland, the now defunct website. I think it was called Poison Tree, about GTA 4, I think. And anyway, in that, he says that all of the people he knows who play video games a lot as adults are like broken in some way. And maybe that's, you know, that's everyone. Everyone is in some way. But I don't know. I think there's maybe video games are just quite comforting. Most games are very fair. You learn the rules of how they work. And if you do the things the game asks you to do, it will reward you for those. It gives you progress. And, you know, there's something comforting about being able to learn and master something quite quickly as well. Those are all factors, I think, probably in like on a like deeper psychological level of what is it that I like about games and why do I keep playing them. There are like some, I'm really into 90s and early 2000s Japanese shoot 'em ups from the arcades, right? Which is quite, you know, there's a small but very dedicated group of people who are really into those. So
what are a few titles?
So like this would be there's a family tree of these that go back to the early 90s or whatever. And maybe people have heard of Raiden, which is an old, you know, early 90s kind of arcade game. But then the famous ones would be things like Dodonpachi, which was made by Cave, which was a studio that worked from sort of 1998 through to about 2012 or something like that. And it's still making games, but now it makes mobile games. It doesn't even make this kind of game anymore, but there's a massive community of people who absolutely love their games and play them all the time. And you know, that's an example of I play those games once a week at least. And you know, I don't necessarily finish them, but I love to just sort of almost like a piece of music, learning it, going over it again and again, sort of getting better at it, perfecting it. And of course, the game gives you a score to quantify your progress and all of that kind of thing. So that I find very appealing about them as well. But yeah, I suppose it's complicated. When you make your hobby into your vocation in some way, so you start writing about the thing that you love, it's complicated. It then becomes really enmeshed in who you are and how you go through the world. And that at some point happened for me, and it's difficult to go back once you've started that process, I think. So, you know, it's difficult to separate playing games from being able to go on living by having food and the shelter. Do you know what I mean? So I don't know. There's that very practical element as well.
What is your current relationship with games? I mean, you sort of touched on it there. Again, you have to play games for certain parts of your work. You have to stay in tune with what's going on in the industry, even if you're not playing, because of the folks you're interviewing and actually have some sense of the history and what's gone on in this industry. And then, you sound like you're still dipping into your old habits here and there as well. So what is that relationship with games right now? Is it exhausting? Is it still exciting?
No, it's not exhausting. I have games that fulfill different functions for me in a really sort of utilitarian way. So I have games that I'm reviewing professionally. I don't do much of that because the economics of it are basically unsustainable in 2024. And unless you're writing, like, I don't know, a 1500 word piece for like legacy prestige media, in which case, fair enough. That's a decent amount of money that you'll get for your time investment. But if, you know, writing for specialist press, if you're reviewing a 60-hour game, you're maybe getting paid, I don't know, $400 or $500 for that tops. And so, you know, the time investment to the payout is not worth it. But like you say, there are loads of ancillary benefits from doing that, and that you get to stay abreast of like how design trends are evolving, what the big games are at any given time. You get to have opinions on things that you can maybe talk about in podcasts or whatever. So just that, it also, there are other benefits other than monetary that I think keep me wanting to review the odd game here and there. Then I play like some online games just as a way to unwind, like especially if I'm deep in a book project, I might write for like 3 or 4 hours in the day and then just need to do something completely different. And so she playing like, I don't know, Warzone or Fortnite for an hour or something is just a great way to have something to just sort of, my brain is still doing, but is a good way to unwind. And then, yeah, I also have just classic games that I love and will put on, like a person might put on a classic record, right? And I will just go and play that game. They tend to be more sort of, you know, I'm not putting on Final Fantasy II, like playing that. Right. It's more like a game that I can play in 15 minutes and I'll get a lot out of, which is why sort of Japanese shoot 'em ups are perfect for that, because I can play that for, you know, 20 minutes and I would have got a great deal out of that and I'll have enjoyed my time, and then I can go back to whatever other real life responsibilities I have. So, those are the kind of ways in which I play games right now in my life.
But you mentioned like the evolution of game design. That's something that I think compels me as well. Is a hook for me is like, what is next? This, I talk a lot about on the show, like this medium is something we grew up, like our generation and maybe a little bit before, grew up alongside. We've seen it evolve along with ourselves. And so there is this sort of unique, I think a unique perspective that we have on it, that I'm sure folks who were born, you know, when film was becoming a thing or when recorded music was becoming a thing, music is a great example. It can become a very different thing once you're able to record it. And then once you're able to record individual tracks, and then once you're able to do more and more in the mixing process, like now it becomes an experiment. You know, you start getting into the Beatles and Beach Boys and what they're doing in the studio. So you can do something completely different with the medium. And I think that's something we get to enjoy or bask in. There is no definition for what this medium can and can't do. Chris Plant's interview was he talked at length about some of the great examples there of like, there are no rules really when it comes down to it.
Yeah.
And that's what's fascinating. And I think for me, that's what keeps me going. Even if I'm not playing it, I want to watch the latest trailer. I want to see what's coming out because I want to see what people are able to do with this thing that seems infinitely difficult on a technical level and artistic level to even create, let alone actually build something that's functional and works. So to me, it's just all magic and it's endlessly appealing. So,
Yeah, I think you're dead right. Like, for anyone who was playing games, pre-3D, that revolution, like pre-Super Mario 64.
Yes.
The moment that happens, it felt momentous in a way that probably people who don't play video games are like, what are you talking about? These are just toys, stop it. But like, if you care about video games and you think they're important, living through that moment was incredible. It just felt momentous, like I say. And you're right. Like that really imprints in some way in your brain, doesn't it? Of like, oh my gosh, I am like a kid or a teenager, or I'm growing up alongside this medium that is evolving sort of at the same rate I am. And it's like people are doing, it can do new stuff and it's kind of coming out into the world and maybe it's going to gain recognition and be taken more seriously, just like I am as I grow older. So you're right, for like people maybe, I don't know, between the ages of, I don't know, like 30 to 45, maybe in that like bracket, maybe it's different to that. You're right, there's something maybe we feel a little differently. I think about kids now, like 12 to 15 year olds, who don't really see graphics in the same way that we do, because they're like, oh yeah, some games look like Elden Ring, some games look like Among Us. That's fine. They're all just aesthetic choices. And that's definitely true. But when you live through a time when only games could look like Among Us, you sort of have a slightly different perspective on the advances that have been made technologically, as well as in terms of the design.
Yeah. Do you recall, I mean, you flashed on Mario 64, because that's a game that I flash on quite often, of like, when was there, what was the crossing of the Rubicon for me that was like, oh, this is something completely different. I think there are many moments. When I listen to your show and I sit there and sit back and think like, what would my five games be? And I never really have a concrete answer, I don't think. But I think about those moments of like, when were the like aha moments? What games were was it like, oh, what the hell is that? Like you had never even conceived or thought about something being possible, and all of a sudden it your imagination runs wild. Do you recall certain games that maybe did that for you?
I mean, I remember seeing Super Mario 64, the video of it in a game store, like when I was, I don't know, quite young, but they had it up on the TV and I didn't get to play it for quite a few years after that. But I remember just seeing Mario swimming through the sea and the camera moving around behind him. This must have been just before the game was out or something, or maybe it was just out. And just thinking, oh, things have changed. Like, this is now different. And Tomb Raider coming out around the same time and, you know, having just a different tone. I mean, you look back at that game now and it looks so basic and rugged in its aesthetic, but it did feel very different. Like, not only the fact it was 3D, but also having Lara Croft as a protagonist. And, you know, those are definitely a couple of moments. I remember playing Final Fantasy VII, which I did play at the time that it came out, and there's the bit early on when Cloud and the rest of the gang jump on the top of a train. They're in Midgar. It's quite early, and they jump on the train as it's going past, and it's like, you know, again, you look at it now and it's like switching so awkwardly between these different art styles. It's like not got any consistency or anything. But at the time, I, you know, as someone who had mainly only played Mega Drive games or whatever, or Genesis games as they are in the US, just thinking, what is going on? How is this possible? You know, what's happening to video games? So, yeah, those were definitely sort of very big moments. I think the 2D to 3D moment was probably the most momentous. And then since then, there have obviously been, it's all sort of variations on that. So Shadow of the Colossus, seeing someone climbing up one of those titans, you know, that was hugely memorable. The first time I played Dark Souls as well, and all of the interesting stuff that game was doing in terms of, you know, the way it treats its player, how much it doesn't tell you, the way that the multiplayer, such as it is, works in that game. It's this very mysterious, opaque thing. And just thinking, this is all new, this is different. Maybe this will catch on. Yeah, just, I guess, so many moments like that. Perhaps they happen less often these days, but then every now and again, a game does come along and restores your sort of reserves of interest.
Yeah.
and sense that, oh yeah, video games can do something new and surprising. And I think it is a medium where, you know, things that are new and surprising are especially valued, because essentially games are about learning stuff. When you play a game, the thing that's exciting about it is going, here's something new, how do I do this? Which is teaching, right? And so there is a certain degree of video games always have to be, novelty is highly prized in terms of the design in this genre, in this medium rather.
Yeah. I'm glad you said that. I think that's, you know, as I try to think about what games appeal to me these days, it's sort of, I don't know if it's becoming few and far between, but again, as my time dwindles and I don't you know, I'm just not able to put in, you know, what I used to. And truthfully, I even have to guess or ask myself, like, what parts of the industry or what parts of this medium do I really care about anymore? And when I get into actually playing the games, it's like I said, I don't play as often and as I would, I don't know if it's as I would like or as I used to, at least, but I'm trying to figure out, like, what are those experiences that I cherish or draw me in, you know? And I think most recently, Tears of the Kingdom, Breath of the Wild before that, but that was something that it was sort of, it bordered on that line of like, this is magic, how is this possible? But less so about like, I could see games doing this, but I have a hard time fathoming how a game of this scale can work on technology this old or limited. I think that's what's most fascinating to me in that regard. And it's just, you know, it's a bottomless pit. There's just so many cool puzzles and things you can do that it's really endless and an engaging world. And then after I finished that, I jumped into, I've been kind of chipping away at a little bit of a backlog, but I played and beat Titanfall 2, which had as I understood, had a really interesting time travel mechanic. And I was like, that was the novel thing I wanted to experience and see how it handled that in that game, which is really just shifting between two different worlds back and forth very quickly on a dime. Spoiler alert. And then I also just beat Return of the Obra Dinn, which again was like, that's a novel experience in the sense of like a game. I mean, it's presented in a novel way, like an old Mac or whatever it happens to be, an old PC. But it's, you know, the idea of you're an insurance adjuster. Like, what? That's fascinating in its own right. But the fact that you just built a logic puzzle around, you know, around this 3D environment and you are trying to piece together something that doesn't actually have all the answers. And can you actually figure out this puzzle? And now I'm working on Chance of Sinar, which again is another sort of logic puzzle. And it's finding I'm not jumping into the latest, you know, AAA shooter. I don't find a lot of novelty in that sort of space. It's these, you know, more indie or niche titles who have the agency and the ability to make something that's maybe a little more, I guess, nuanced or out there and take a risk that a big AAA studio just generally can't. Are there any games, I guess more modern games that you've found or kind of scratched that itch for you that have felt sort of novel and I guess unique, for lack of a better word?
Yeah, I mean, it's similarly Tears of the Kingdom. I felt that way about it. Really, you know, it consumed my attention. I played it for a really long time, but I didn't feel like it was ever wasting my time.
Yeah,
in a way that some of those big open world games, you know, it can be like, collect 200 of these, go over there. And it definitely feels as like filler. And I don't know, somehow Nintendo managed to avoid that to a certain degree. I'm playing Dragon's Dogma 2 at the moment, which it's just got loads of interesting stuff. I mean, it kind of looks a bit like Elden Ring. It looks a bit like The Witcher 3, but it's got loads of interesting stuff happening under the hood that I'm finding very compelling, interesting, dynamic. And I tend to value games that have that more emergent gameplay rather than the very scripted stuff. But then there's a place for the scripted stuff as well. Like, I enjoy Uncharted and The Last of Us, you know, enough. Sure. And some they have a place as well. But the stuff that really gets me excited is like, yeah, where you get some interesting emergent gameplay stuff. Absolutely.
Here's a weird question that I'm now starting to ask myself again about this medium. It starts with playing it and being fascinated by what's going on screen and what you're able to control. But I also feel like part of me is starting to change, and maybe this is just me getting older, but I'm questioning, are the games what's most fascinating about this medium these days, or is it sort of the larger economics around the entire medium now? Again, as we've, and this is just coming off my head right now as I'm saying it, but I feel like, you know, when we were young, you mentioned that idea of like, we saw that transition from 2D to 3D, and it was kind of this mind-blowing thing. And there was that genuine moment of like, oh, maybe other people will actually get this sort of niche hobby I have. Maybe this is a chance for it to kind of blossom and grow. And it's sort of akin to like when you find a band that you really like, a small indie band that you really like, and you sort of hope the best for them. You also want them to continue to remain yours, and you're protective over it. But I think there was that genuine, even today, I still get that like protective sort of knee-jerk reaction to the medium of like, no, this is something bigger. It's no longer a niche. But and in fact, it is. And the economics of it will tell you that it certainly is much bigger than just a niche. It is not a niche anymore. But I'm starting to now wonder, like, is that what's becoming fascinating about it? Do you find the business of all of this fascinating, or is it still just the games itself?
Well, I mean, it's difficult to separate sometimes, because so often the economics of how a game makes its money will have an impact on the way it's designed, right? That's
sure.
That's been true since the days of the arcade, where, you know, designers were explicitly trying to make it so their players could only play for 3 minutes and then they'd be off. And they either would put another quarter in or the next guy can have a go, you know? And so all the way through the medium, you know, we see that now with Battle Pass design in those, you know, sort of games as service titles. You see it in, you know, more and more studios are like, we want to do like a game as service open world game because they're all gunning for that. If we can turn our game into Instagram in the sense that it's something that people log into every single day and it's part of their life and they play it for 5 years, then we're quits in. But, you know, for me, the more interesting stuff are people who, you know, like Lucas Pope, who you mentioned making Obra Dinn. It's like, I'm actually going to spend 6 months making a small self-contained game that really explores a couple of interesting ideas, rather than the kind of design that's trying to just hook a player in and keep them coming back daily and blah, blah, blah. So yeah, like my knee-jerk reaction is I'm not interested in the business side of like games, but of course I am, because it has such an impact on the kind of games that they get to play and enjoy. You know, the other element to what you were talking about there is what space the game video games occupy in culture. And that I am interested in, because as someone who works, you know, a lot of my efforts are trying to communicate what it is that is good and interesting about video games to broader culture, and to very often to cultural gatekeepers. So by that, I mean, like, you know, editors on newspapers or magazines or websites saying, you know, you should let me write about this particular thing that's coming out because it's meaningful and interesting. Yeah, you know, and that is an interesting conversation. And I was listening to your episode with Robert Ashley from A Life Well Wasted, and he was kind of talking about when he was young, he just longed for video games to be taken seriously by culture at large, or played by a much larger amount of people. And now they are, he kind of like slightly curses that wish, or can't quite deal with it. And I understand that as well. Like, you know, video games are ubiquitous, aren't they? But not always in ways that, it's not always people talking about the things that I find interesting about games, but you know, that I can suppose that's part of it. You know, that becoming widespread and becoming massively popular, is there are going to be all kinds of different conversations about, you know, why games are interesting, why they're meaningful. You know, I don't think they, for all that they make loads of money, right? There's a cliche in writing about games is that in your first paragraph, you go, hey, guess what? The video game industry makes 3 times more than Hollywood's, right? People have been doing that since like 1983 or whatever. And it, to the point that it's now, you know, it's something that, you know, if you're a professional writer on games and you see someone doing that, it's just a massive eye roll, even though, you know, it's of course like a useful way to communicate to people games matter financially, economically, and they do, but like culturally they're still like parochial, they're still, you know, a backwater, and there are various reasons for that. You know, they're not hip-hop, they're not even movies, you know, they're certainly not Netflix or anything. They're still like this, it's like, you know, they're played by millions and millions of people, but they're not talked about in the same way in the culture. And, you know, there are lots of reasons for that. But, you know, some of my work is trying to get them talked more about in the culture. But, yeah, so I am definitely interested in that aspect of what you were saying.
Is there, to I hate using this phrase, to circle back to the beginning of the show and mentioning Death by Video Game, that book in and of itself, there is this sort of, you know, cautionary tale, I guess, a little bit about the dangers of the medium. Is that potentially, is that something that...
Well, yeah, in a very real way, because it's about a spate of deaths at internet cafes in China and South Korea.
Right.
Where people would like play an online game for 2 or 3 days straight without moving, without drinking enough water, and would just die like at their computer. So, you know, that's the jump off point. You know, and it gives the book its sort of slightly provocative title. And, you know, the jump off point is what is it about a video game that would compel a person to stay sitting in front of a screen for 3 days until they lose their life? And, you know, then talk about all the different ways that they do that. Yeah, like I suppose anyone who writes about video games, who he produces podcasts like this, you know, that's definitely part of the thing that animates us and goes, you know, what is it about this thing that I'm spending so much time with that makes me do that? Is it, you know, as my teachers warned when I was 8 years old, a massive waste of time, or is there something else going on here, or is it both of those things at different times? So that does still interest me. I think, you know, just the act of saying, I'm going to play a game and I'm going to write about it in a professional capacity, or I'm going to record an episode about it, is by its very nature saying, what is it about this thing that I find interesting or compelling that's causing people to spend their time with it? That's what the job is. Yeah.
Yeah. On that note too, and I've mentioned this on the show before, I've struggled with that bit of, am I wasting time? Like, what is wasting time, I guess, becomes the question. And the way I've, I guess, tricked myself into being okay with playing video games, because whenever I do, I feel this like sense of guilt doing it, is I just try to substitute me scrolling online on, you know,
right,
Twitter or X or whatever, or Threads. Like, I'm probably wasting more time doing that and feeling guilty,
right, right,
feeling terrible at the end of the day. It may not feel guilty in the moment, but I sign off and I feel bad. Like,
right, right. That is the number one activity for humans right now, right? Is being on TikTok or Instagram stories or Facebook Live, whatever your age demographic is, they've got a version for you. And just sitting there, scrolling up, watching the next one. And whatever video games are, I think they're better than that. So it's kind of hard, I think, for anyone to look down. You know, it's not like people are spending all their time reading Nabokov or whatever. It's like, no, like most people are spending most of their time watching dogs catch balls or like people falling off their bikes or whatever. So, you know, you can't look down your nose at me trying to figure out all the ways in which people died and return to the Obra Dinn.
Right, right, right. You're making me feel accomplished now. I feel really good about myself. That I
won't go that far, but...
I'm being cognizant of time right now, and I appreciate you giving me at least an hour to chat with you. I do like asking people what they are, what excites them about the future of games, and somebody like yourself who just puts so much time and effort into this medium, chronicling it and you know, chatting with folks who, you know, from all walks of life who are fascinated by this medium. I feel like you may have a unique perspective on not predicting the future and seeing where it's going, but is there anything that you kind of see around the corner, or you're glad the conversation is heading in a certain direction?
I mean, it's tough because there's so much to be despondent about. I think there's just, you know, mass layoffs in the industry, 17,000 workers losing their jobs in just the last 4 months, you know, and in my industry of media and publishing, it's like a similar story. So people who cover games, there's fewer and fewer places to do that. So, you know, it's harder for people to make games. It's harder for people to write and read about games. You know, more and more of the big companies just, they seem to only want to invest in surefire hits that are going to hook people in and keep them playing. Everything wants to be Fortnite, right? In this, not in terms of game mechanics, but in terms of like the user acquisition and all of that, to use horrible industry terms. So all of that stuff is, I don't know, I think works against the idea of creativity and the real interesting stuff that results in games that people become very meaningful in a person's life. Not to say that, you know, those games don't have their place, and they do provide, you know, a virtual playground where you can meet up with friends and do all kinds of wholesome, useful activities. But yeah, for me, like, what is it about video games that I find really exciting? And it's those designers who are giving us new kinds of ideas. They're giving us new contexts, place it, new people to play as, new start, you know, blending different genres, all of that stuff, which really sort of the financials of the industry are not especially set up very well to help support at the moment. And yet, you know, designers find a way. People who have been inspired by some of the games that we're talking about, who are game designers, those are the kind of games they want to make. They want to make a game that will be like Obra Dinn or like Shadow of the Colossus. It's going to mean something to a young person, perhaps, that those games meant to them when they were growing up. And so we do see games coming through that are, you know, wonderful and novel and insightful and give us new kinds of experiences. And I think that will always be true. It's just a shame that right now it seems harder than ever to make those kind of games. And so I'm hopeful that you know, this is cyclical, and that the, you know, the big weathers of the financial markets that lead to some of the effects that we've seen recently in the industry, they'll change at some point, and then hopefully we'll see finance coming in again that will enable creative people to do creative things. But yeah, right now things are tricky.
Yeah, yeah. And I think about this often, you know, ballooning budgets and all of this, and we don't need to get into the details of it. But I also wonder, for a long time, I've been hoping for shorter games, you know, lots of shorter, more novel experiences. And I wonder if this moment signals that might be, you know, more sustainable in some regard. I mean, if you flood the market with tons of games, then that's going to be harmful in a sense of discovery. That's a challenge in the podcasting industry. It's been a challenge in music. It's a challenge with all kinds of mediums. So that's one side effect. But the other is you're not, you know, spending, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars as a risk at a gamble that ultimately affect, you know, hundreds, if not thousands, of people's lives at the end of the day. I don't know. I don't think any of us know the right answer. And we'll just, like you said, we'll, you know, see how the storm is weathered and see what happens on the other side of it. But
yeah,
I think we can all hope for something better than what's going on right now.
Definitely.
I'm going to let you go in just a moment. The last question I have, and you may not be at liberty to say, but I'd be remiss if I didn't ask. What are the five games on your perfect console?
Oh, I get asked this a lot, and I just have to say no. Because I even had like one guest on my show literally asked me like halfway through, like, tell us one of your games, and I had to cut that bit out because I was like, I think I might do it at some point as like an episode, and I do get asked like quite a lot to do that, but yeah, I'm not at liberty to say right now.
I figured it was a stretch. That's got to be how the show ends at some point. You know,
quite possibly.
Yes, that'd be a good one. Save it for then. I had to ask. The show is brilliant. You obviously have a full calendar of stuff that you are working on. You're putting out episodes once a week. You're continuing to do reviews and write for folks. You know, I see you step into the Guardian's Pushing Buttons, you know, newsletter every now and then. Oh, there's Simon stepping in. And then, you know, I guess loads of interviews. And do you have another book in the works right now? Or are you working on?
Yeah, I've got a book out in August in the UK, and I think it's in September in the US. So yeah, like since I started doing My Perfect Console, my life is really busy, but in an enjoyable way.
Yeah, yeah. Just the fact, I mean, doing this show alone, I put the first 10 episodes out and it was more like record when I could and then stack them all together and then release on a schedule. And I've learned that, you know, now that I have a daughter and work is crazy, there's just no way I can sustain it. So it's just kind of, it comes out whenever it comes out.
Yeah.
So looking at a show like yours, where you're putting out so much, it feels like just tons and tons of content and having tons of these interviews. I mean, I just commend you for doing that. That's wild. I don't have anything else to say other than I hope you get some sleep here and there.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, I think I'm okay to end it at some point and that'll be fine. But when I started, I was like, if I'm going to do this, I want to do it for a year and I want to do one a week for a year. And then I'll just see at the end of that if I want to keep going or not. And I think I'm just going to do that at the end of every year and just sort of see if I'm still getting something out of it. I don't want the conversations to get stale or repetitive or anything like that. So I don't know. Okay, we'll see. But right now I'm having a blast.
I just want to say I appreciate your time. I appreciate you giving me your time. This is a true honor for me. Again, falling in love with your writing first and foremost, but again, I love your work and you know what you get out of this medium, what you're able to extract and kind of put on the page for people to read and appreciate. I think you do successfully, at least in my eyes, you successfully broach that gap of folks who may not understand what this medium is, but you can paint a very clear picture about what it actually is and what's interesting about it for others.
Thank you, Carl. That's so kind of you. Really, really encouraging. Thank you.
You bet. Well, I'll let you go. I'll look forward to more episodes of My Perfect Console and your writing in the future. Thank you very much, Simon.
Thanks, buddy.
If you want to hear more from Simon, I would strongly encourage you to check out his podcast, My Perfect Console. I mentioned it at the top of the show. There's a lot of similarity between this show and his show. That is totally coincidental. When I started this show, I wasn't really aware of his, and then all of a sudden I happened upon it, and it was just like a, you know, again, very, very, very similar takes, interviewing people about the role and the meaning of games in their lives. I will also include a link to Simon's website and his books and writing that you can find online. There's a lot of great stuff out there. Oh, that's right. The Guardian puts out a bi-weekly newsletter done by Kezia McDonald called Pushing Buttons. And sometimes Simon jumps in and contributes to that as well. So you might find his writing on that. I would strongly encourage you to subscribe to that too. It's a great newsletter. In this episode, I mentioned a few games that I had been playing. I wanted to say that I have finished Chance of Sinnar, which was a lovely video game. I highly recommend it. Also, Simon and I mentioned Return to the Obra Dinn a few times. If you enjoyed that game or are thinking about playing it, I might recommend the latest book by David Gran, the author of Killers of the Flower Moon, his book called The Wager, about the mutiny that occurred on the British warship The Wager in 1741. Lots of similarities between the two experiences. Obra Dinn might be better after reading The Wager, but I'm finding The Wager to be way more fun now that I've explored an old warship and its crew in a video game. Anyway, there you go. Just a little recommendation. The Wager and Obra Dinn, both great. If you enjoyed this episode or the show in general, please share it with a friend. The easiest thing to do might be to share the website whybutton.online. That includes links to most podcast platforms. I'd also appreciate a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever supports that kind of thing. If you want to get in touch, ask me questions, or recommend guests, feel free to reach out to whybuttonpodcast@gmail.com or on Threads or Instagram at whybuttonpodcast or on Mastodon at whybutton@mastodon.social. You can also find me on Threads and Instagram at _KyleStar or Mastodon at KyleStar@mastodon.social. This episode was produced by AJ Filari. AJ, thanks for being open to allowing a robot to assist with this one. The theme song was written by ChildStar, which is me, featuring my friend Scott Wilkie. It's called On the Same Page. You can find it on all streaming platforms. Thanks again for listening to Y Button. And remember, when you press Y, ask why.